Hello and welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity that helps people with cancer find out about and utilise integrative medicine to support their recovery. Today's show focuses on an area of health that's been in the news a lot in recent years. A little while back, no one had even heard of the microbiome, but now it's regular tabloid material. I'm pleased to be able to talk to a real expert on this territory, microbiologist and nutritional therapist, Dr. Carol Granger. I'm speaking to Dr. Granger over the internet. Carol, welcome back to the Yes Life Show.
Hi, it's really nice to be back. It's nice to be invited to discuss this interesting area with you today.
Okay, well, would you believe it's actually 3 years since you last came on to talk about safe integration of nutritional therapy with conventional treatments?
Gosh, can't believe how much time has gone so quickly.
But a lot has happened since then. So today we're going to focus in on the role of the gut in health. And I want to start off by asking, well, recently we've heard a lot about the gut, more and more about the importance of the microbiome. In the long run, how much do you think this will turn out to be a case of it being kind of fashionable? Because, of course, you know, even in the world of health and medicine, there's always hype around new findings. And today's news is tomorrow's fish and chip paper, as they say. How much of the hype will stand the test of time, do you think?
I think you're right that there does seem to be a lot of hype around the knowledge about the microbiome. I mean, there's lots of television programs, there's lots of articles. I have a feeling about this one that more than half of the enthusiasm about it is really justified. And what I find encouraging is that it's actually answering many questions that have remained unanswered, and that people that are working in mainstream cancer care are also looking at this area. So I think it's an area, yes, there's some hype in it, but I think also it's an area where there's going to be a confluence and a coming together of opinion, really, because I think it's a very important area and it answers many questions about health.
Okay, interesting. So for listeners who maybe don't know you, would you tell us a little bit about your background and your training and about what you're working on currently?
Okay, so I actually started my sort of working life in mainstream healthcare sciences. I mean, I trained, I did biochemistry and microbiology, and I ran a microbiology lab for quite a few years and did my master's in microbiology on something called endotoxin, which is something that bacteria shed. And in fact, now that's really a very important area of interest in health. And I did that for sort of 20 years and worked in various jobs in biochemical diagnostics and microbiology and medical devices as well, and even in a human tissue bank. And then I had a change of career. I retrained when I was 40. Retrained as a nutritional therapist, and now I work as a nutritional therapist. I picked up a bit of herbal medicine training along the way. So I work as a nutritional therapist mostly with people with a cancer diagnosis, but I also see some people with neurological conditions, and I also do some other things. So I'm a co-chair of the Research Council for Complementary Medicine. So I'm really interested in the sort of professional body side of things and helping practitioners to collect evidence and helping practitioners to work in an increasingly professional way. So one of my big areas of interest is collaborating across professions. And when I did my doctorate at University of Westminster, I looked at the practice of nutritional therapy for people affected by cancer and looked particularly at how nutrition practitioners can collaborate with other professionals, with oncologists and with cancer teams and so on. So that's my sort of interest. And just sort of touching back on the microbiology bit, one of the reasons why I'm so interested in the microbiome is it pulls together my interest in microbes, many different types of microbes, and the nutrition world. So that's why it's kind of, it's great that it's becoming such an area of interest and a lot of research going on.
Well, I guess that background you have in microbiology is quite unusual for someone who's a nutritional therapist. It must be a fantastic kind of basis to be standing on.
Yeah, I find it. And it, when I worked in a lab and I used to grow microbes, and one of the things that I'm really aware of now is that when I originally did work in a microbiology lab, we were really quite restricted in the way that we could identify bacteria. It was really a case of you could only pick them up if you knew what they wanted to eat and then you had the right growth media for them. But of course, now we've got all these wonderful genetic techniques, so you can identify so many more bacteria. You can find out what really is in the gut because you can look at all the DNA that's in there. And that's really the techniques in microbiology have actually, they've exploded the amount of knowledge that we can have. Whereas the original microbiome tests that I used to do when I started in practice, then that was really culture techniques. And they were okay, but they were quite restricted. Whereas now all of these genetic techniques, it's wonderful because you can look from a stool sample, you can actually look, you can look all the DNA from the different microbes that are in there. And as long as your library of DNA is accurate that you're comparing your sample to, then you can identify your hundreds of different species. And we know that there are many, many different species in there, but the techniques of microbiology have actually made it a much more interesting area. And the information that we get from these tests actually means that we can make much better decisions based on them.
Interesting. All right. Well, I'd like to speak about that a bit more later. So I particularly want to talk about the microbiome in relation to immunity today, but I wonder first if you could do a roundup of all the ways in which our bodies interact with our gut and the effect that a healthy or a poor microbiome can have on our health and well-being.
Okay, so that's a really good question. And just to sort of give some idea of what the microbiome is, where it is, and also to expand a little bit on the idea of the microbiome in the gut, because what we know is that the microbiome, that's actually the collection of all the DNA, that's the genetic material of all the different microbes that are living in and on the body. And the interesting thing is that the microbiome is not just in the gut. So it used to be thought of as that the rest of the body was pretty much clean and sterile, but you had all of these microbes in the gut. And it's very interesting because the microbes in the mouth, which are different in different with different diets, they actually have an impact on the microbes in the gut. And what we do know is that that has a big impact on the immune system. So I'll give you a couple of examples. If you have somebody that has periodontal disease, they have got pockets of microbes in their mouth and they are carried down every time they eat and every time they swallow and every time they drink, they're carried down into the gut. And those unfavorable microbes can actually trigger all kinds of things. They can trigger inflammation. So when we think about the interactions between the microbiome and immunity, there's far more to it than just what's going on in the gut. And so whereas when I did my nutritional therapy training, we used to say, you know, all roads lead to the gut. Everything is really in the gut. And if you get the gut sorted out, then you get everything else sorted out. And there's a lot of truth in that, but also there's much more to it because what's in the gut is also what's in the mouth and what's in the esophagus and in the stomach. So the interactions between the microbes and the immune system happen throughout the body on all of the wet surfaces, and particularly in women. So there's the vaginal microbiome as well, and that has an impact on immunity. So we know that there are these multiple interactions going on and that everything that goes into the mouth has an impact on the immune system because it's having an impact on the microbes in the mouth, and then those microbes are going down into the gut. So there's sort of these complexities of interactions, and particularly so if we want to think about where the biggest interaction is, it's really in the intestines. That's where the biggest interaction is because the microbes stay there for a long time and they interact with white blood cells in the blood vessels lining the intestine. So that's the biggest scene of interaction of between the immune system and the microbes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, do you want to say a bit about how, you know, the ways in which whether this colony of bacteria is seen as a healthy colony or otherwise, how that affects our overall health?
Okay. So there's a couple of areas that we really don't know about, and it sounds as if we're clear about these things, but we're really not. So there's probably what we know about the microbiome probably constitutes, even 1% of the knowledge that we need to collect in order to make better decisions about it. So in terms of what a healthy microbiome looks like, then I guess that the first word to really put out there is diversity. And that's what really matters. So it's not just one or two species of microbes that are really good. Now, there are some that are really good, but there's also some that aren't very favorable. But the most important thing is that you have a very diverse microbiome. And that means lots of different species. And as a good example, there's been some research going on looking at different groups of people around the world that have different types of lifestyles, and if you are different diets, and if you go and look at people who live on an if you look at people on an industrialized diet where there's a lot of processed food and alcohol and also lots of environmental things that they're exposed to, then they've actually got very few species of microbes in their gut and elsewhere. Then if you go and look at the gut of somebody who's living on an unprocessed diet in an unindustrialized area, then you find that they've actually got a really wide range of microbes, and not just bacteria. They'll probably have a few parasites in there as well. And we know actually that some of those can be quite helpful for the immune system in some cases. Mm. They'll have a few yeasts thrown in, but overall they have a much more diverse microbiome. And so the broader the microbiome, the broader the range of species in your microbiome, the greater the range of signals that the immune system gets exposed to. And so this is it's answering many questions about the differences between diets in different parts of the world. And you look at some sort of some groups and you say, why is it that they don't get these chronic diseases? Why don't they get these problems? Whereas people living in the industrialized world seem to suffer more with them. And it does seem that a big part of it is that the microbiome in people living on what I would call an industrialized diet, the kind of Western diet, they've actually got far fewer species of microbes in their microbiome. And that doesn't give their immune system as much of a workout.
Right.
So it's not just one. There are one or two species that are really helpful, but we know are really helpful. But more than anything, it's diversity that makes a difference.
Right. So there's a direct correlation between diversity and the health of the microbiome. A healthy microbiome is one that's very diverse.
Right. And just to sort of look into that further. So when they've taken some people, they've taken stool samples from people, and they've looked at their microbes and looked at their diet and found this nice correlation. And there've been a few experiments where they got people to swap diets. And so they've taken people that are living on an industrialized diet and said, okay, we want you to eat this very unprocessed food. And they used, for example, a group of African Americans, and they took some people living in a rural African location who were on a very unprocessed diet, and they got them to swap their diets. And then they took stool samples, and they saw that it only took a matter of a couple of days for the people that were rural Africans living on an unprocessed diet, when they were put on the so-called industrialized diet from North America, they lost vast numbers of species of microbes in a very short time. So that was the link with their diet. And so it doesn't take long for you to lose many of these species when you lose dietary diversity, and particularly where you're losing lots of plant foods from the diet.
Well, the flip side of that, of course, though, is that actually it's not too hard to build it up again.
That's a really good point there, Robin, because what it does mean is that for many people, a simple intervention that they can do is to try to eat many more different types of plant foods. And most of the foods that feed your good microbes are plant foods, but there's a few that are not plant foods. So, for example, oily fish seems to be something that helps to support the growth of some helpful bacteria, but it's mostly plant foods. And so for many people, an intervention that is relatively easy to do is to just increase the range of vegetables that you eat, as unprocessed as possible. Now, obviously, there are some people where there are restrictions on that. So I work with people that have had lots of gastric, they've had lots of surgery on the gastrointestinal system for cancer. So there may be, and there may also be people with food intolerances, but that in itself, the food intolerances can develop as a result of problems in the microbiome. So, and obviously people need sort of individual care as to how they might do those things if they've got those specific restrictions. But just increasing the range of plant foods that are eaten on a regular basis is one way of increasing the range of species that are present in, particularly in the gut.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that's very positive. It's interesting to kind of note the parallel here with agriculture, where the reducing the number of species that are generally around, like, you know, apples. So there's just a handful of species get sold in supermarkets to the majority of the public. Well, you know, that has an effect in the environment, you know, reducing the number of species, but that also has an effect on us in exactly the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good analogy, actually.
Hmm. Okay, so what would you've already mentioned some of the things we know of that support or suppress a healthy microbiome. Are there other things which, you know, are key factors we should know about?
Okay, so when I work with my clients to try and improve their microbiome, I say there's three pillars to improving your microbial health. And the first one is to actually eat. And if I can say at the beginning, there are some people who, because of the way that because of the treatments that they're going through for cancer, for example, they may not be able to do some of the things that I'm going to talk about. So always look at your own situations and discuss with your own healthcare professionals if these measures are appropriate for you. But in general, there's sort of three pillars to the good microbial health. The first one is to actually eat foods that provide some good microbes. And so these are cultured foods. So for dairy foods, they are things like yogurt and kefir and creme fraiche and a few of the cheeses as well. But predominantly what most people will come across is yogurt and kefir. And there are also other similar sort of fermented dairy foods like labneh, which is a Middle Eastern sort of sieved yogurt type thing. So the idea, the first pillar of that kind of looking after your microbes is to eat some foods that give you good microbes. So that if you can't really go wrong if you choose these sort of cultured yogurts or kefirs or labneh. Obviously, there are some people that can't have dairy, so there are some non-dairy ones, but by looking for ones that say that they're live or that they contain live cultures, that's a good one. And there are other cultured foods as well. So things like sauerkraut, kimchi, even cider vinegar, live apple cider vinegar. So they all provide you with good microbes. So now the thing with sauerkraut is a lot of sauerkraut that's sold in supermarkets is actually pasteurized, and they do that to give it a long shelf life. But when they pasteurize it, they're actually killing off all the good microbes. So you need to have these things live. So when you're buying them, then look for ones that say, you know, live cultures or unpasteurized. But all of those will provide you with good microbes. So that's the first kind of pillar of the microbe support, is you take some good microbes in cultured foods or fermented foods. The second pillar is actually the most important bit, really. The second pillar is, as I mentioned before, diversity in your intake of microbes. So what you're going to be looking at is having what are called prebiotic foods. So the ones that give you the live bacteria, those are called probiotic foods, and you can have probiotic supplements as well. But then the foods that actually feed your good microbes, they're called prebiotic foods. And they include things like mushrooms, butter beans, lots of different green vegetables, green olives, olive oil, So lots of different, and in fact, pretty much all unprocessed plant foods, vegetables, fruit, nuts and seeds, they provide prebiotic components, and that's because they contain different types of fibers. And those fibers are the food that your microbes want to live on. And what your microbes do is they ferment those fibers and they produce some very good beneficial compounds that actually help your gut. So those prebiotic foods, they can. So think of a big diversity of different vegetables. So as many different colors of vegetables as you can, that gives you lots of different vitamins. But the broad range of diversity of your vegetables and things like spices and herbs and nuts and seeds, all those plant foods, they will help different species of microbes to grow. Because bacteria have their own little dietary needs. So some bacteria can only live on certain types of compounds and others live on other types of compounds. So that's the second kind of pillar of microbial health, is those prebiotic foods. So you've got the probiotic give you the good microbes, the prebiotics feed the good microbes. And the last one is actually to avoid things that deplete the beneficial microbes. And that's really, it's really two main things in the Western lifestyle. And that's if you can reduce alcohol intake, because alcohol does deplete the level of good microbes in the intestine and elsewhere. And also avoid refined sugar, because what we know is that people that have a lot of sugar in their diet, that actually does suppress the diversity. So a high sugar intake is linked to a lower range of microbes in your gut. So missing out those two adverse compounds, alcohol and sugar, that's a good move. So those are the kind of three pillars of microbial health. It's the good microbes, that's the probiotics, it's feed the good microbes with the prebiotics, and avoid the things that deplete the good microbes, that's alcohol and sugar.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You didn't mention, my generation was very much brought on the only good thing to do with a microbe is to squirt it with Dettol or bleach or something. Over cleanliness and the consumption yeah. of things which actually kill microbes directly that are meant to, and maybe antibiotics as well. You haven't mentioned that group of things. Do you feel that's because they don't feature as prominently as the things you have mentioned?
I think that they're very important. That's a really good point that you make. I think that the three sort of pillars that I suggested are ones that people have direct control over. Mm. Whereas for people that are, for example, people going through treatment, we know that lots of medication will actually knock out microbes very rapidly. So if you have to have a course of antibiotics, then that's going to knock out a lot of your microbes. It certainly won't knock out all of them, but it will knock out many of the ones that you need most of all. So it's really a case of that, obviously, for people that are in treatment, the various conditions, they may not have so much control over the things that they have to take, but they do have control over what they're eating.
Yeah.
And so now it's a really good point that you mentioned about compounds that kill off microbes. And there's even some research looking at using things like antiseptic soaps on their skin are also potentially depleting the microbes in their intestine. So the over-enthusiastic use of disinfectants in the environment, that actually seems in the home, for example, that seems to be linked to an increased risk of developing allergies. And that's because when kids are growing up in a very clean, ultra clean home, then they're not exposed to the good microbes that help their immune system to be educated properly. Mm. So it's a very good point that you make. And I think when people are thinking about allergies, then overexposure to these cleanliness, to these ultra sort of disinfectant compounds, that can be a problem. Of course, now we're in a slightly different situation at the moment with coronavirus, where people are having to wash their hands more often, and they are being encouraged to, you know, be more cautious about perhaps bringing microbes back into the home. So they might be disinfecting shopping when they get it and so on. But I think this is an unusual situation that we're in at the moment. But in general, using a lot of disinfectants everywhere, and certainly using things like antimicrobial soaps and shower gels, they're not really that good for the health of the microbiome overall in the body.
Yeah, and another thing that sort of jumps to mind is, of course, you're saying obviously vegetables and fruit and etc. are great for the microbiome, but some vegetables and fruit have been doused with things which inherently are not great for the microbiome. So the type of shopping you do must play into it to some degree.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think that obviously reflects the fact that people that live in rural locations in parts of the world where they have an unprocessed diet, where they may be just giving a sort of cursory rinse to vegetables or brushing the dirt off them, they're going to get exposure to lots of different microbes from soil, which is helpful. So, and it's always got to be a bit of a balance, because obviously if you pick something out of your garden and you use it, then you know hopefully you've not sprayed your courgettes with pesticides and so on, so that's good. But when people are buying vegetables that are not organic, and then yes, there may be traces of things on the outside of the vegetable which would also have an impact on the microbiome. And many root vegetables are treated post-harvest with a fungicide so that gives them a longer shelf life. And of course, when we take that into the body, then it does have an impact on our own microbes.
So hence the sort of big difference, if you like, between the industrialized nations and the non-industrialized ones. There are many ways in which we're not really supporting our microbiome that well.
Yes.
Well, given that, how widespread would you say poor gut health is in the UK?
Well, if I just went on the basis of the people that I see in my practice, then I'd say it's probably most of the adult population. But I'd say that nobody has really looked accurately at the UK population or at European populations and said how many people have poor gut health. But obviously, there were ongoing studies looking at the microbiome in the gut. And in general, particularly if you look in the UK, then I would say that there's a fairly widespread problem with low levels of good microbes and low diversity in the microbiome. And certainly if you look at the difference between the microbiome in healthy people and the microbiome in people with specific diagnoses, you'll find differences. And there's some really good work going on at the moment where they're looking at the sort of fingerprint of the microbiome of people with different types of chronic diseases, with autoimmune diseases, with different types of cancers, and then comparing them to people of a similar age, ethnicity, and gender who don't have those conditions. And what they're finding is that it's very clear that people with chronic health problems have a poorer microbiome than people that don't have those health conditions. Now, of course, the question is always going to be, and it's one of those sort of chicken or egg questions, you know, what comes first? Is it that the microbiome is depleted because the person's unwell, or is the person unwell because their microbiome is adversely affected? But it's very clear that, for example, people with type 2 diabetes generally have a poorer range of microbes in their gut compared to aged, matched people who don't have type 2 diabetes. And the same with every type of cancer that's been looked at, and with all the autoimmune conditions and neurological conditions, they're consistently finding impairment of health is associated with a poorer microbiome. So loss of key species and overall a lower range of species, and the presence of some unpleasant ones as well, a greater presence of some unpleasant ones.
Well, as you say, it's a kind of chicken and egg question, but the association is a very important one, clearly, and one we need to understand more about. Okay, so homing in on the main topic, the relationship between gut health and immunity. Well, firstly, of course, there are many factors that affect the immune system, how effective it is. Where would you rank gut health amongst those?
I'd say that I have a kind of top two when I work with people that have, for example, people with a cancer diagnosis. I say, first thing that we need to do is to sort out your gut. And then we also need to have a look at your nutrients, predominantly vitamin D, because vitamin D is really important for immunity. It's probably the most important if I say mainstream vitamin, I mean very well-researched vitamin for immunity, but gut health, it really is. So the gut health really is, it's a marker of what's going on with the microbes. And so where people have digestive system problems, then you can be sure that alongside that is a disturbance in the microbes, and that has an impairment, or that causes an impairment of the immune response. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that it is extremely important. Now, there might be obviously other, for individuals, you know, that if I look at each person as an individual, but when I look at somebody's symptoms and I see that they've had long-standing digestive system symptoms like bloating and bowel disturbance and wind and just general feeling of discomfort in their abdomen, then that is a signal that their immune system is not going to be served well by their gut microbes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so looking after our microbiome should be right up there in our strategies to build our immunity. In the case of cancer and cancer treatment, and what are the specific factors working against the health of our microbiome that we should be aware of?
Okay, that's a really good question, because that's the largest group of patients that I work with in my practice. So thinking sort of first of all about how treatments affect the microbiome, most chemotherapy agents given intravenously will also affect the microbiome, because they have an impact. Obviously, they spread throughout the whole of the body. But also the supporting medication. So when people are going through chemo treatment, they're pretty much all given other supporting drugs like dexamethasone, usually the anti-nausea drugs like ondansetron and so on, and metoclopramide. And all of those have an impact on the gut microbes. So as somebody goes through their chemotherapy, through their cycles, their every 2 or 3 week cycles, then they will often see a change in bowel habit. And that's a very common observation, is they might have a few days where they're very constipated and a few days where their bowels are loose. And during the cycle, the microbes will actually be depleted. Now, you might say, well, is that a price worth paying? Well, actually, yes, it is a price worth paying, because you can take these repairing steps to help put the good microbes back in there. A couple of things just to mention is that where people are given anti-nausea drugs, then the anti-nausea drugs talk with your team if you find that they're also causing bowel disturbance, because if they're doing that, then they're having an impact on the microbiome as well. In terms of how you can protect yourself during that time, it's following those steps that we mentioned earlier about having some cultured foods, as long as your medical team are okay with you having live foods, and eating, even if it's only small amounts, lots of different types of vegetables. So that will help your good microbes to be restored. And of course, as you go through each cycle, then just to try and keep that up. And obviously, if you have individual dieting needs, then talk to your team, talk to your nutrition practitioner if you're working with one, about how you can incorporate those, that use of those wide range of microbes from different vegetables and so on into your dietary regime. In terms of other treatments, there's some really interesting research about immunotherapy. And immunotherapy, of course, is now being more widely used. These are drugs like what we call checkpoint inhibitors. So drugs like nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and so on. And what we know is that people having those treatments, these are more widely used now, people having those treatments seem to have a better response if they have a broad range of microbes in their intestine. So their microbiome seems to also help the immune system alongside these checkpoint inhibitors. And that's why people who are having immunotherapy, and so immunotherapy is used in things like head and neck cancers, certainly used in melanoma. I have a lot of patients with melanoma that are having these checkpoint inhibitor drugs, also called PD-1 inhibitors. If you have good microbes in your system, that is like a boot camp. If you have good microbes in your gut, it's like a boot camp for your immune system. And just one last thing, if I can mention, Robin, is about radiotherapy. So when people have pelvic radiotherapy, that also disturbs the microbes in the intestine. And so in that case, again, it's important to try and follow those sort of three pillars of microbial support that I mentioned. trying to make sure that you eat something with some good microbes in, eat some foods that feed the good microbes, and avoid the things that deplete your good microbes. So treatment can have quite a significant impact on the microbes, but it is possible to recover from that.
Mm. All very important stuff to know. So as a practitioner, Carol, you must want to know what the condition of your client's gut is, and also whether your efforts to improve it are actually proving effective. How do you measure the health of the microbiome?
Okay, so thankfully there's some really good tests around now. So I do microbiome tests on people, and they get a kit, and they send a stool sample, or generally the test that I use would want to collect stool samples over a few days and then send those off to laboratories. And there are several laboratories doing these tests now. I'd say choose a laboratory that's validated, go with the one that your practitioner, if you're working with a practitioner, go with the one that they recommend. But there's lots of labs that are doing these studies, and they should be using DNA techniques. So the DNA techniques basically harvest all of the DNA that's in the stool sample, and then they compare that DNA against a library of DNA fingerprints that have been set up from different bacteria. So the kind of DNA is the gold standard now, looking at the DNA for the microbes. And the reason for that is that if you just do culture techniques, then you miss out on bacteria that can't survive in your culture conditions. So some of the older stool tests that were being done were really just using culture methods, and it's like working in the dark, it really is. But the new techniques are good, so it's using the DNA analysis. I would also do culture techniques, and so these are done by the laboratories that I use, and then the culture techniques are looking at which microbes are surviving, which ones are thriving, because when you get a DNA result back, that's got all the DNA from the bacteria, you don't know how many of those bacteria are dead and how many are alive, because you're just looking at their DNA. Whereas alongside that, I would have the culture method done as well of specific species. So I'm looking for specific species that I know are important. And they are, I mentioned earlier that it's diversity is the most important thing, but there are one or two key leading species that are very important for immunity. And these are things like the ruminococcus, lactobacilli, bifidobacteria, faecalibacterium. That's a really important one in terms of immunity for people with a cancer diagnosis, and particularly people going through immunotherapy. So there are lots of tests out there, and they are very helpful. Some also do direct microscopy to look for parasites. So yes, that's really the only way to do it. So you can't sort of work in the dark without these results. They are expensive. Some of these tests are really quite expensive. Mm. So I would only use them judiciously at the time that's an appropriate time. I wouldn't ask somebody going through chemotherapy to do one of those tests while they're in treatment. I would wait until they finish treatment and 3 months past the last infusion, because otherwise you don't get a good idea. But because they're quite expensive. I mean, they're a couple of £100, these tests. And so to have them done in the middle of a course of chemo is not worth it, because you know that the next week they're going to get another big dose of dexamethasone, and that dexamethasone is going to knock everything out.
Yeah, guaranteed that their microbiome is suffering if they're having chemo, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And because these tests are expensive, they're not done on the NHS, so they're done privately. And because they are expensive, it's not really... if somebody's going through straightforward chemotherapy, I would wait until the end of the chemo regime. But if they're going through immunotherapy, that's different. So somebody who is going through immunotherapy, it's worthwhile looking at the microbiome at any time during that, because you know that the microbes in the gut are having a direct impact on the result from that treatment.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Okay, I'd like to round off with a more general question about the approach to healthcare. I know that you're passionate about integrative medicine, something we have in common, but we've come to it from rather different angles. I certainly don't have your kind of expertise and experience, but could you tell us exactly why you think that integration is the right way forward for the management of cancer, chronic illness, and generally in health?
Okay, that again is a really good question. I think it's because people that have a serious health condition, and that obviously includes cancer, but also other health problems as well, like neurological problems and autoimmune conditions, they actually deserve the best of all care. And that's why I feel that if practitioners of different professions can work together, then we all gain. The person with the health problem gains most of all. And I think one of the areas that this has really come home to me is working with people with a cancer diagnosis, is that they can feel that they're kind of put in the middle of a bit of a tug of war. And that isn't fair. That isn't fair on the individual. Whereas if the two sides of healthcare, which I don't see it in sides, I see it really as different, that we have different perspectives. If we can come together and come up with the best possible wraparound care for that individual, then that's important. And I've been working in two collaborations really that have reinforced to me how important it is that we communicate. I'm involved in a collaboration within the NHS research arm, so the National Institute of Health Research, which is the NHS research arm. They have a collaboration on nutrition for cancer patients, and I began contributing to that when I was doing my doctorate. I think I'm just about the only person who's not working in the NHS that's in that collaboration, but my voice is heard. I'm listened to, and recently we just had a paper accepted for publication, and it's people from different, so there's dietitians, and there's a breast surgeon, and there's gastroenterologists, and there's a health psychologist, and me as a nutrition practitioner in the private sector, all talking about how people with a cancer diagnosis can get the best evidence-based nutrition advice. And it was working within that collaboration. And yes, it's hard work. Some of it's really hard work. But working in that collaboration has made me realise that the people that will benefit most of all from us all working together are the people with the health issue. Mm. I also do a bit of work with a group of oncologists as well, where I do some writing for them about nutrition. And working with them and listening to their perspective and realising how important it is that we all talk together. So yeah, you can tell that I'm really passionate about it. And that's why I've been in my sort of years in the profession, I've been always volunteering in different bodies that have tried to help professional development. And now I'm co-chairing the Research Council for Complementary Medicine. And that's really all about making it possible for patients to get the best of all care. Whether it's mainstream healthcare, that's what they get, which is wonderful. But also making sure that the voice of the complementary services is understood and that their contribution is accepted on the basis of evidence, on the basis of the fact that we actually do good work, that we help the patient.
Mm. Excellent. Thank you. That's very clear. All right. Well, look, we'll end it there. Thanks so much, Carol. It's been really informative. I'm looking forward to seeing you at our amazing online autumn event, Your Life and Cancer 2020, spread across 2 weekends. You're in amongst over 40 top international experts featuring in discussions, and you're scheduled to be interviewed by expert host Miguel Toribio Mateus, who is a neuroscientist, a nutritionist, a microbiome researcher, and chairman of the British Association for Nutrition and Lifestyle Medicine. So I'm thinking this should make for a fascinating discussion, which I'm sure will add considerably to the material we've covered today.
That's great. I'm really looking forward to that. That's wonderful.
Thanks so much for this interview. It's been brilliant, as I say, very informative, and I hope our listeners have gained from it.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
The growing understanding of the central role of the microbiome is beginning to produce the science to underpin many of the dietary and nutritional approaches that have been found to be helpful over the years. Hopefully, this will lead to a greater respect for the role that nutrition has to play in recovery from serious diseases like cancer. As I mentioned, Carol is one of over 40 experts featured in our online event in just a very few weeks, Your Life and Cancer 2020. It's spread across 2 weekends, 26th to 28th of September and 10th to 12th of October. The first one is tailored to those new to integrative medicine, and the second to people wanting to expand their knowledge. The event has its own website at yourlifeandcancer.com, so do check out the extraordinary lineup of speakers and subject matter. You can also book your place at either or both weekends for just £25 per weekend, as long as you catch the early bird prices. Thanks for listening today. I'll be back at the same time next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. So I do hope you'll be able to join me again. Goodbye. Thank you.